to and fro, skimming like a canopy over the fish, silently perched and rocked on this pole, the long tail feathers streaming like pennons. A gentle joyousness, a mighty mildness of repose and swiftness invested the gliding whale. No wonder there had been some among the hunters who, transported and allured by all this serenity, had ventured to assail it, but had fatally found that quietude but the vesture of tornadoes. Yet calm, enticing calm, O whale, thou glidest on. And thus, through the serene tranquillities of the tropical sea, Moby Dick moved on, still withholding from sight the full terrors of his submerged trunk, entirely hiding the wrenched hideousness of his jaw. But soon the forepart of him slowly rose from the water. For an instant, his whole body formed a high arch, and warningly waving his bannered flukes in the air, the grand god revealed himself, sounded, and went out of sight. Hoveringly halting and dipping on the wing, the white sea fowls longingly lingered over the agitated pool that he left. With oars apeak and paddles down, the sheets of their sails adrift, the three boats now floated, awaiting Moby Dick's reappearance. "An hour," said Ahab, standing rooted in his boat's stern, and he gazed beyond the whale's place towards the dim blue spaces and wide wooing vacancies to leeward. It was only an instant, for again his eyes seemed whirling round in his head as he swept the watery circle. The breeze now freshened, and the sea began to swell.
"The birds! The birds!" cried Tashtego.
In long Indian file, as when herons take wing, the white birds were now all flying towards Ahab's boat, and when within a few yards began fluttering over the water there, wheeling round and round with joyous, expectant cries. Their vision was keener than man's. Even Ahab could discover no sign in the sea. But suddenly, as he peered down and down into its depths, he saw a white, living spot no bigger than a white weasel, with wonderful celerity uprising and magnifying as it rose, till it turned, and then there were plainly revealed two long, crooked rows of white, glistening teeth, floating up from the undiscoverable bottom. It was Moby Dick's open mouth and scrolled jaw, his vast, shadowed bulk still half blending with the blue of the sea. The glittering mouth yawned beneath the boat like an open-doored marble tomb, and giving one sidelong sweep with his steering oar, Ahab whirled the craft aside from this tremendous apparition. Then calling upon Fedallah to change places with him, he went forward to the bows and, seizing his harpoon, commanded his crew to grasp their oars and stand by to stern. Now, by reason of this spinning round the boat upon its axis, its bow, by anticipation, was made to face the whale's head while yet under water. As if perceiving this stratagem, Moby Dick, with that malicious intelligence ascribed to him, sideways transplanted himself, as it were in an instant, shooting his pleated head lengthwise beneath the boat. Through and through every plank and each rib, it thrilled for an instant. The whale obliquely lying on his back in the manner of a biting shark, slowly and feelingly taking its bows full within his mouth, so that the long, narrow, scrolled lower jaw curled high up into the open air, and one of the teeth caught in a rowlock. The bluish pearl white of the inside of the jaw was within 6 inches of Ahab's head, and reached higher than that. In this attitude, the white whale now shook the slight cedar as a cruel cat her mouse. With unastonished eyes, Fedallah gazed and crossed his arms, but the tiger-yellow crew were tumbling over each other's heads to gain the uttermost stern. And now, while both gunwales were springing in and out, as the whale dallied with the doomed craft in his devilish way, and from his body being submerged beneath the boat, he could not be darted at from the bows, for the bows were almost inside of him, as it were. And while the other boats involuntarily paused, then it was that Ahab, furious with this tantalizing vicinity of his foe, which placed him all alive and helpless in the very jaws he hated, seized the long bone with his naked hands and wildly strove to wrench it from its grip. As now he thus vainly strove, the jaw slipped from him. The frail gunwales bent in, collapsed, and snapped, as both jaws bit the craft completely in twain and locked themselves fast again in the sea, midway between the two floating wrecks. These floated aside, the broken ends drooping, the crew at the stern wreck clinging to the gunwales and striving to hold fast to the oars to lash them across. At that preluding moment, ere the boat was yet snapped, Ahab made one final effort to push the boat out of the bight, but only slipping further into the whale's mouth and tilting over sideways as it slipped, the boat had shaken off his hold on the jaw, spilled him out of it as he leaned into the push, so that he fell flat-faced upon the sea. Ripplingly withdrawing from his prey, Moby Dick now lay at a little distance, vertically thrusting his oblong white head up and down in the billows, and at the same time slowly revolving his whole spindled body, so that when his vast, wrinkled forehead rose some 20 or more feet out of the water, the now rising swells, with all their confluent waves, dazzlingly broke against it. But soon resuming his horizontal attitude, Moby Dick swam swiftly round and round the wrecked crew, sideways churning the water as if lashing himself up to still another and more deadly assault. The sight of the splintered boat seemed to madden him. Meanwhile, Ahab, half smothered in the foam of the whale's insolent tail, and too much of a cripple to swim, though he could still keep afloat, was seen like a tossed bubble which the least chance shock might burst. From the boat's fragmentary stern, Fedallah incuriously and mildly eyed him. The clinging crew at the other drifting end could not succor him. More than enough was it for them to look to themselves. For so revolvingly appalling was the white whale's aspect, and so swift the ever-contracting circles he made, that he seemed horizontally swooping upon them. And though the other boats, unharmed, still hovered hard by, still they dared not pull into the eddy to strike, lest that should be the signal for the instant destruction of the jeopardized castaways. Nor in that case could they themselves hope to escape. Meantime, from the beginning, all this had been descried from the ship's mastheads, and squaring her yards, she had borne down upon the scene. She was so nigh that Ahab in the water hailed her, "Sail on the whale! Drive him off!" The Pequod's prow was pointed, and breaking up the charmed circle, she effectually parted the white whale from his victim. As he sullenly swam off, the boats flew to the rescue. Dragged into Stubbs' boat with bloodshot, blinded eyes, the white brine caking in his wrinkles, the long tension of Ahab's bodily strength did crack, and helplessly he yielded to his body's doom, for a time lying all crushed in the bottom of Stubbs' boat, like one trodden underfoot of herds of elephants. Then he said, "Hands off for me! I see him, there, going to leeward still! Set the sail! Out, oars!" It is often the case that when a boat is stove, its crew, being picked up by another boat, help to work that second boat, and the chase is thus continued with what is called double-banked oars. It was thus now. But the added power of the boat did not equal the added power of the whale, swimming with a velocity which plainly showed that if now, under these circumstances pushed on, the chase would prove an indefinitely prolonged, if not a hopeless one. Nor could any crew endure for so long a period such an unintermitted, intense straining at the oar. The ship itself, then, as it sometimes happens, offers the most promising intermediate means of overtaking the chase. Accordingly, the boats now made for her, and were soon swayed up to their cranes, the two parts of the wrecked boat having been previously secured by her. And then hoisting everything to her side and stacking her canvas high up, the Pequod bore down in the leeward wake of Moby Dick. At the well-known methodic intervals, the whale's glittering spout was regularly announced from the manned mastheads, and when he would be reported as just gone down, Ahab would take the time, and then pacing the deck, binnacle watch in hand, so soon as the last second of the allotted hour expired, his voice was heard.
"Whose is the doubloon now? Do you see him?"
And if the reply was, "No, sir," straight away he commanded them to lift him to his perch. In this way the day wore on, Ahab now aloft and motionless, anon unrestingly pacing the planks. And as he was thus walking, at every turn he passed his own wrecked boat, which had been dropped upon the quarter-deck and lay there, reversed broken bow to shattered stern. At last he paused before it. Stubb saw him pause, and perhaps intending, not vainly, though, to evince his own unabated fortitude, and thus keep up a valiant place in his captain's mind, he advanced, and eyeing the wreck exclaimed,
"The thistle the ass refused. It pricked his mouth too keenly, sir. What soulless thing is this that laughs before a wreck? Man, man, did I not know thee brave as fearless fire, I could swear thou wert a poltroon. Groan nor laugh should be heard before a wreck. Begone! Aloft there, do you see him? Sing out for every spout, though he spout 10 times a second.
The day was nearly done. Only the hem of his golden robe was rustling. Soon it was almost dark, but the lookout men still remained unset.
"Can't see the spout now, sir. Too dark," cried a voice from the air.
"How heading when last seen?"
"As before, sir. Straight to leeward."
"Good. He will travel slower now 'tis night. Down royals and topgallant stunsails, Mr. Starbuck. We must not run over him before morning. He's making a passage now and may heave to a while. Helm there! Keep her full before the wind. Aloft! Come down! Mr. Stubb, send a fresh hand to the foremasthead and see it manned till morning."
Then, advancing towards the doubloon on the mainmast,
"Men, this gold is mine, for I earned it. But I shall let it abide here till the white whale is dead. And then, whosoever of ye first raises him, upon the day he shall be killed, this gold is that man's."
And so saying, he placed himself halfway within the scuttle, and slouching his hat, stood there till dawn, except when at intervals rousing himself to see how the night wore on. At daybreak, the three mastheads were punctually manned afresh.
"Do you see him?"
cried Ahab, after allowing a little space for the light to spread.
"See nothing, sir."
"Turn up all hands and make sail. He travels faster than I thought. The topgallant sails, aye, they should have been kept on her all night. But no matter, 'tis but resting for the rush."
Here be it said that this pertinacious pursuit of one particular whale, continued through day into night, and through night into day, is a thing by no means unprecedented in the South Sea fishery. For such is the wonderful skill, prescience of experience, and invincible confidence acquired by some great natural geniuses among the Nantucket commanders, that from the simple observation of a whale when last descried, they will, under certain given circumstances, pretty accurately foretell both the direction in which he will continue to swim for a while out of sight, as well as his probable rate of progression during that period. The ship tore on, leaving such a furrow in the sea as when a cannonball, missent, becomes a plowshare and turns up the level field.
"There she blows! She blows right ahead!"
was now the masthead cry.
"Aye, aye," cried Stubb. "I know it. Ye can't escape. Blow on and split your spout. The mad fiend himself is after ye."
And Stubb did but speak out for well nigh all that crew. The frenzies of the chase had by this time worked them bubblingly up, like old wine worked anew. Whatever pale fears and forebodings some of them might have felt before, these were not only now kept out of sight through the growing awe of Ahab, but they were broken up, and on all sides routed as timid prairie hares that scatter before the bounding bison. The hand of fate had snatched all their souls, and by the stirring perils of the previous day, the rack of the past night's suspense, the fixed, unfearing, blind, reckless way in which their wild craft went plunging towards its flying mark, by all these things, their hearts were bowled along. The wind that made great bellies of their sails and rushed the vessel on by arms invisible as irresistible, This seemed the symbol of that unseen agency which so enslaved them to the race. They were one man, not 30. For as the one ship that held them all, though it was put together of all contrasting things, oak and maple and pinewood, iron and pitch and hemp, yet all these ran into each other in the one hull, which shot on its way, both balanced and directed by the long central keel. Even so, all the individualities of the crew, this man's valor, that man's fear, guilt and guiltlessness, all varieties were welded into oneness, and were all directed to that fatal goal, which Ahab, their one lord and keel, did point to. The rigging lived. The mastheads, like the tops of tall palms, were outspreadingly tufted with arms and legs. Clinging to a spar with one hand, some reached forth the other with impatient wavings. Others, shading their eyes from the vivid sunlight, sat far out on the rocking yards, all the spars in full bearing of mortals, ready and ripe for their fate. How they still strove through that infinite blueness to seek out the thing that might destroy them.
"Why sing ye not out for him if ye see him?"
cried Ahab, when after the lapse of some minutes since the first cry no more had been heard.
"Sway me up, men! Ye have been deceived. Not Moby Dick casts one odd jet that way and then disappears."
It was even so. In their headlong eagerness, the men had mistaken some other thing for the whale spout, as the event itself soon proved. For hardly had Ahab reached his perch when the triumphant halloo of 30 buckskin lungs was heard, as, much nearer to the ship than the place of the imaginary jet, less than a mile ahead, Moby Dick bodily burst into view. For not by any calm and indolent spoutings, not by the peaceable gush of that mystic fountain at its head, did the white whale now reveal his vicinity, but by the far more wondrous phenomenon of breaching. Rising with his utmost velocity from the furthest depths, the sperm whale thus booms his entire bulk into the pure element of the air, and piling up a mountain of dazzling foam, shows his place to the distance of 7 miles and more. In those moments, the torn, enraged waves he shakes off seem his mane. In some cases, this breaching is his act of defiance.
"There she breaches! There she breaches!"
was the cry, as in his immeasurable bravados the white whale tossed himself salmon-like to heaven. So suddenly seen in the blue plain of the sea, and relieved against the still bluer margin of the sky, the spray that he raised, for the moment, intolerably glittered and glared like a glacier, and stood there gradually fading and fading away from its first sparkling intensity to the dim mistiness of an advancing shower in a veil.
"Aye, breach your last to the sun, Moby Dick," cried Ahab. "Thy hour and thy harpoon are at hand. Down, down all of ye, but one man at the fore, the boat stand by."
Unmindful of the tedious rope ladders of the shrouds, the men, like shooting stars, slid to the deck by the isolated backstays and halyards, while Ahab, less dartingly but still rapidly, was dropped from his perch.
"Lower away,"
he cried, so soon as he had reached his boat, a spare one rigged the afternoon previous.
"Mr. Starbuck, the ship is thine. Keep away from the boats, but keep near them. Lower all!"
As if to strike a quick terror into them, by this time being the first assailant himself, Moby Dick had turned and was now coming for the three crews. Ahab's boat was central, and cheering his men, he told them he would take the whale head and head, that is, pulled straight up to his forehead. A not uncommon thing, for within a certain limit, such a course excludes the coming onset from the whale's sidelong vision. But ere that close limit was gained, and while yet all three boats were plain as the ship's three masts to his eye, the white whale churning himself into furious speed, almost in an instant, as it were, rushing among the boats with open jaws and a lashing tail, offered appalling battle on every side, and heedless of the irons darted at him from every boat, seemed only intent on annihilating each separate plank of which those boats were made. But skillfully maneuvered, incessantly wheeling like trained chargers in the field, the boats for a while eluded him. But at last, in his untraceable evolutions, the white whale so crossed and recrossed, and in a thousand ways entangled the slack of the three lines now fast to him, that they foreshortened, and of themselves warped the devoted boats toward the planted irons in him. Now for a moment the whale drew aside a little, as if to rally for a more tremendous charge. Seizing that opportunity, Ahab first paid out more line, and then was rapidly hauling and jerking in upon it again, hoping that way to disencumber it of some snarls, when lo, a sight more savage than the embattled teeth of sharks. Caught and twisted, corkscrewed in the mazes of the line, loose harpoons and lances, with all their bristling barbs and points, came flashing and dripping up to the chocks of Ahab's boat. Only one thing could be done. Seizing the boat knife, he critically reached within, through the rays of steel, dragged in the line beyond, past it, inboard to the bowsman, and then, twice sundering the rope near the chocks, dropped the intercepted steel into the sea, and was all fast again. That instant, the white whale made a sudden rush among the remaining tangles of the other lines, by so doing, irresistibly dragging the more involved boats of stub and flask towards his flukes, dashing them together like two rolling husks on a surf-beaten beach, and then, diving down into the sea, disappeared in a boiling maelstrom in which, for a space, the odorous cedar chips of the wrecks danced round and round like the grated nutmeg in a swiftly stirred bowl of punch. While the two crews were yet circling in the waters, reaching out after the revolving line-tubs, oars, and other floating furniture, while a slope little flask bobbed up and down like an empty vial, twitching his legs upwards to escape the dreaded jaws of sharks, and Stubb was lustily singing out for someone to ladle him up, and while the old man's line, now parting, admitted of his pulling into the creamy pool to rescue whom he could, in that wild simultaneousness of a thousand concreted perils, Ahab's yet unstricken boat seemed drawn up towards heaven by invisible wires, as, arrow-like, shooting perpendicularly from the sea, the white whale dashed his broad forehead against its bottom and sent it turning over and over into the air until it fell again, gunwale downwards, and Ahab and his men struggled out from under it. The first uprising momentum of the whale, modifying its direction as he struck the surface, involuntarily launched him along it, to a little distance from the center of the destruction he had made. With his back to it, he now lay for a moment slowly feeling with his flukes from side to side, and whenever a stray oar or a bit of plank, the least chip or crumb of the boats, touched his skin, his tail swiftly drew back and came sideways, smiting the sea. But soon, as if satisfied that his work for that time was done, he pushed his pleated forehead through the ocean, and trailing after him the intertangled lines, continued his leeward way at a traveler's methodic pace. As before, the attentive ship, having descried the whole fight, again came bearing down to the rescue, and dropping a boat, picked up the floating mariners, tubs, oars, and whatever else could be caught at, and safely landed them on her decks. Some sprained shoulders, wrists, and ankles, livid contusions, wrenched harpoons and lances, inextricable intricacies of rope, shattered oars and planks, all these were there. But no fatal or even serious ill seemed to have befallen anyone. As with Fedallah the day before, so Ahab was now found grimly clinging to his boat's broken half, which afforded a comparatively easy float. But when he was helped to the deck, all eyes were fastened upon him.
"Aloft there!" he cried at once. "Which way?"
"Dead to leeward, sir."
"Up helm, then! Pile on the sail, shipkeepers! Down the rest of the spare boats and rig them! Mr. Starbuck, away and muster the men! Surely I have not seen him yet! By heaven, it cannot be! Missing? Quick, call them all!"
The old man's hinted thought was true. Upon mustering the company, the Parsee was not there.
"The Parsee," cried Stubb. "He must have been caught in the—"
"The black vomit wrench thee! Run, all of ye! above, below, cabin, forecastle, find him!
Not gone, not gone!
But quickly they returned to him with the tidings that the Parsee was nowhere to be found.
Aye, sir, said Stubb, caught among the tangles of your line. I thought I saw him dragging under.
My line? Gone? What means that little word? What death knell rings in it, that old Ahab shakes as if he were the belfry? Quick, all hands to the rigging of the boats. Collect the oars. Harpooneers, the irons. Hoist the royals higher. A pull on all the sheets. Helm there, steady for your life. I'll 10 times girdle the unmeasured globe, yea, and dive straight through it, but I'll slay him yet.
Great God, cried Starbuck, never, never wilt thou capture him, old man. In Jesus' name, no more of this. 2 days chased, twice stove to splinters. The evil shadow gone, all good angels mobbing thee with warnings. What more wouldst thou have? Shall we keep chasing this murderous fish till he swamps the last man? Shall we be dragged by him to the bottom of the sea? 'Tis blasphemy to hunt him more.
Starbuck, of late I've felt strangely moved to thee. Ever since that hour we both saw, thou knowest what, in one another's eyes. But in this matter of the whale, be the front of thy face to me as the palm of this hand, a lipless, unfeatured blank. Ahab is forever Ahab, man. This whole act's immutably decreed. 'Twas rehearsed by thee and me 1 billion years before this ocean rolled. I am the fate's lieutenant. I act under orders. Look thou, underling, that thou obeyest mine.
Ahab turned to the watching crew.
Stand round me, men. Ye see an old man propped up on a lonely foot. But ere I break, ye'll hear me crack. Until ye hear that, know that Ahab's hawser tows his purpose yet. Believe ye, men, in the things called omens? Then laugh aloud and cry encore, for ere they drown, drowning things will twice rise to the surface, then rise again to sink forevermore. So with Moby Dick. 2 days he's floated. Tomorrow will be the third. Aye, men, he'll rise once more, but only to spout his last.
Then, as the men went forward, he muttered,
the things called omens, the Parsee gone, and he was to go before me, but still was to be seen again ere I could perish. How's that? There's a riddle might baffle all the lawyers. I'll solve it, though.
When dusk descended, the whale was still in sight to leeward. Once more the sail was shortened, and everything passed nearly as on the previous night. Only the sound of hammers and the hum of the grindstone was heard till nearly daylight, as the men toiled by lanterns in the complete and careful rigging of the spare boats and sharpening their fresh weapons for the morrow. Meantime, as on the night before, Ahab stood fixed within his scuttle, his glance set due eastward for the earliest sun. The morning of the third day dawned fair and fresh, and once more the solitary nightman at the foremast head was relieved by crowds of the daylight lookouts, who dotted every mast and almost every spar.
Aloft there, cried Ahab. What do you see?
Nothing, sir.
Nothing. And the day at hand, the doubloon goes a-begging.
I've oversailed him, then. Aye, he's chasing me now, not I him.
That's bad. I might have known it, too. Fool, the lines, the harpoons he's towing. Aye, I have run him by last night.
About! About! Come down, all of ye, but the regular lookouts. Man the braces!
Steering as she had done, the wind had been somewhat on the Pequod's quarter, so that now being pointed in the reverse direction, the braced ship sailed hard upon the breeze as she re-churned the cream of her own white wake. Against the wind he now steers for the open jaw, murmured Starbuck to himself as he coiled the new-hauled main brace upon the rail. God keep us, but already my bones feel damp within me, and from the inside wet my flesh. I misdoubt me that I disobey my God in obeying him.
Stand by to sway me up,
cried Ahab,
advancing to the hempen basket.
We should meet him soon.
Aye, aye, sir. And straightway Starbuck did Ahab's bidding, and once more Ahab swung on high. A whole hour now passed, gold beaten out to ages. Time itself now held long breaths with keen suspense. But at last, some 3 points off the weather bow, Ahab descried the spout again, and instantly from the 3 mastheads, 3 shrieks went up.
Forehead to forehead I meet thee this third time, Moby Dick. On deck there, brace sharper up, crowd her into the wind's eye. He's too far off to lower yet, Mr. Starbuck. Stand over that helmsman with a top maul. He travels fast, and I must down. What's that the Parsee said? He should still go before me, my pilot, and yet be seen again. But where? Will I have eyes at the bottom of the sea, supposing I descend those endless stairs? And all night I've been sailing from him, wherever he did sink to. Aye, like many more, thou toldest the direful truth as touching thyself, O Parsee, but Ahab, there thy shot fell short. Goodbye, masthead. Keep a good eye upon the whale while I'm gone. We'll talk tomorrow. Nay, tonight, when the white whale lies down there, tied by head and tail.
He gave the word, and still gazing round him, was steadily lowered through the cloven blue air to the deck. In due time the boats were lowered, but as standing in his shallop stern, Ahab just hovered upon the point of the descent. He waved to the mate, who held one of the tackle ropes on deck, and bade him pause.
Starbuck!
Sir!
For the third time my soul's ship starts upon this voyage, Starbuck.
Aye, sir, thou wilt have it so.
Some ships sail from their ports, and ever afterwards are missing, Starbuck.
Truth, sir. Saddest truth.
Some men die at ebb tide, some at low water, some at the full of the flood. And I feel now like a billow that's all one crested comb, Starbuck. I am old. Shake hands with me, man.
Their hands met, their eyes fastened.
Oh, my captain, said Starbuck, noble heart, go not, go not. See, it's a brave man that weeps. How great the agony of the persuasion, then.
Lower away,
cried Ahab, tossing the mate's arm from him.
Stand by the crew.
In an instant the boats were pulling around close under the stern. Scarce had they pushed from the ship when numbers of sharks, seemingly rising from out of the dark waters beneath the hull, maliciously snapped at the blades of the oars every time they dipped in the water, and in this way accompanied the boat with their bites. It is a thing not uncommonly happening to the whaleboats in those swarming seas, the sharks at times apparently following them in the same prescient way that vultures hover over the banners of marching regiments in the east. The boats had not gone very far when, by a signal from the mastheads, a downward-pointed arm, Ahab knew that the whale had sounded. But intending to be near him at the next rising, he held on his way a little sideways from the vessel, the becharmed crew maintaining the profoundest silence as the headbeat waves hammered and hammered against the opposing bow. Suddenly, the waters around them slowly swelled in broad circles, then quickly upheaved, as if sideways sliding from a submerged berg of ice, swiftly rising to the surface. A low, rumbling sound was heard, a subterraneous hum, and then all held their breaths, as bedraggled with trailing ropes and harpoons and lances, a vast form shot lengthwise, but obliquely from the sea. Shrouded in a thin, drooping veil of mist, it hovered for a moment in the rainbowed air, and then fell swamping back into the deep. Crushed 30 feet upwards, the waters flashed for an instant like heaps of fountains, then brokenly sank in a shower of flakes, leaving the circling surface creamed like new milk round the marble trunk of the whale.
Give way,
cried Ahab to the oarsmen, and the boats darted forward to the attack. But maddened by yesterday's fresh irons that corroded in him, Moby Dick seemed combinedly possessed by all the angels that fell from heaven.
the wide tiers of welded tendons overspreading his broad white forehead beneath the transparent skin looked knitted together. As head-on, he came churning his tail among the boats, and once more flailed them apart, spilling out the irons and lances from the two mates' boats, and dashing in one side of the upper part of their bows, but leaving Ahab's almost without a scar. While Dagu and Tashtego were stopping the strained planks, and as the whale swimming out from them turned and showed one entire flank as he shot by them again, at that moment a quick cry went up. Lashed round and round to the fish's back, pinioned in the turns upon turns in which, during the past night, the whale had reeled the involutions of the lines around him, the half-torn body of Fedala, the Parsi, was seen, his sable raiment frayed to shreds, his distended eyes turned full upon old Ahab. The harpoon dropped from his hand.
"Befooled," he cried, drawing in a long, lean breath. "Aye, Parsi, I see thee again. Aye, and thou goest before. And this, then, is the hearse that thou didst promise. But I hold thee to the last letter of thy word. Where is the second hearse? Away, mates, to the ship. Those boats are useless now. Repair them if ye can in time and return to me. If not, Ahab is enough to die. Down, men! The first thing that but offers to jump from this boat I stand in, that thing I harpoon. Ye are not other men, but my arms and my legs, and so obey me. Where's the whale? Gone down again?"
But he looked too nigh the boat, for as if bent upon escaping with the corpse he bore, and as if the particular place of the last encounter had been but a stage in his leeward voyage, Moby Dick was now again steadily swimming forward, and had almost passed the ship, which thus far had been sailing in the contrary direction to him, though for the present her headway had been stopped. He seemed swimming with his utmost velocity, and now only intent upon pursuing his own straight path in the sea.
"Oh, Ahab," cried Starbuck, "not too late is it, even now the third day, to desist. See, Moby Dick seeks thee not. It is thou that madly seekest him."
Setting sail to the rising wind, the lonely boat was swiftly impelled to leeward by both oars and canvas. And at last, when Ahab was sliding by the vessel, so near as plainly to distinguish Starbuck's face as he leaned over the rail, he hailed him to turn the vessel about and follow him, not too swiftly, at a judicious interval. Glancing upwards, he saw Tashtego, Queequeg, and Dagu eagerly mounting to the three mastheads, while the oarsmen were rocking in the two staved boats which had just been hoisted on the side, and were busily at work repairing them. One after another, through the portholes as he sped, he also caught flying glimpses of Stubb and Flask, busying themselves on deck among bundles of new irons and lances. And as he saw all this, as he heard the hammers in the broken boats, far other hammers seemed driving a nail into his heart. But he rallied, and now marking that the vane or flag was gone from the mainmast head, he shouted to Tashtego, who had just gained that perch, to descend again for another flag and a hammer and nails, and so nail it to the mast. Whether fagged by the 3 days' running chase, and the resistance to his swimming and the knotted hamper he bore, or whether it was some latent deceitfulness and malice in him, whichever was true, the white whale's way now began to abate, as it seemed, from the boat so rapidly nearing him once more, though indeed the whale's last start had not been so long a one as before. And still, as Ahab glided over the waves, the unpitying sharks accompanied him, and so pertinaciously stuck to the boat, and so continually bit at the plying oars, that the blades became jagged and crunched, and left small splinters in the sea at almost every dip.
"Heed them not," cried Ahab. "Those teeth but give new rowlocks to your oars. Pull on."
"But at every bite, sir," cried the nearest oarsman, "the thin blades grow smaller and smaller."
"They will last long enough. But who can tell," Ahab muttered, "whether these sharks swim to feast on the whale or on Ahab? But pull on, all alive now, we near him. Take the helm, let me pass.
And so saying, two of the oarsmen helped him forward to the bows of the still flying boat. At length, as the craft was cast to one side and ran ranging along with the white whale's flank, he seemed strangely oblivious of its advance, as the whale sometimes will, and Ahab was fairly within the smoky mountain mist which, thrown off from the whale's spout, curled round his great hump. He was even thus close to him when, with body arched back and both arms lengthwise high lifted to the poise, he darted his fierce iron and his fiercer curse into the hated whale. As both steel and curse sank to the socket, as if sucked into a morass, Moby Dick sideways writhed, spasmodically rolled his nigh flank against the bow, and, without staving a hole in it, so suddenly canted the boat over that had it not been for the elevated part of the gunwale to which he then clung, Ahab would once more have been tossed into the sea. As it was, three of the oarsmen, who foreknew not the precise instant of the dart, and were therefore unprepared for his effects, these were flung out, but so fell that, in an instant, two of them clutched the gunwale again, and rising to its level on a combing wave, hurled themselves bodily inboard again, the third man helplessly dropping astern, but still afloat and swimming. Almost simultaneously, with a mighty volition of ungraduated, instantaneous swiftness, the white whale darted through the weltering sea. But when Ahab cried out to the steersman to take new turns with the line and hold it so, and so commanded the crew to turn round on their seats and tow the boat up to the mark, the moment the treacherous line felt that double strain and tug, it snapped in the empty air. Hearing the tremendous rush of the sea-crashing boat, the whale wheeled round to present his blank forehead at bay. But in that evolution, catching sight of the nearing black hull of the ship, seemingly seeing in it the source of all his persecutions, bethinking it a larger and nobler foe, he bore down upon its advancing prow, smiting his jaws amid fiery showers of foam. Ahab staggered. His hands smote his forehead.
I grow blind. Hands, stretch out before me that I may yet grope my way. It's night. The whale! The ship!
Cried the cringing oarsman.
Oars! Oars! Slope downwards to the depths, O sea, that ere it be forever too late, Ahab may slide this last time upon his mark. The ship! The ship! Dash on, O my men! Dash on! Will ye not save my ship?
But as the oarsmen violently forced their boat through the sledge-hammering seas, the before whale-smitten bow-ends of the two planks burst through, and in an instant almost, the temporarily disabled boat lay nearly level with the waves, its half-wading, splashing crew trying hard to stop the gap and bail out the pouring water. Meantime, for that one beholding instant, Tashtego's masthead hammer remained suspended in his hand, and the red flag, half-wrapping him as with a plaid, then streamed itself straight out from him, as his own forward-flowing heart, while Starbuck and Stubb, standing upon the bowsprit beneath, caught sight of the down-coming monster just as soon as he.
"The whale!" cried Starbuck. "The whale! Up helm! Up helm! Oh, all ye sweet bowers of air, now hug me close! Up helm, I say! Ye fools! The jaw! The jaw! Oh, Ahab, Ahab, lo thy work! Steady, helmsman, steady! Nay, nay, up helm again! He turns to meet us! Oh, his unappeasable brow drives on towards one whose duty tells him he cannot depart! My God, stand by me now!"
"Stand not by me," now cried Stubb, "but stand under me, whoever you are that will now help Stubb, for Stubb too sticks here. I grin at thee, thou grinning whale, whoever helped Stubb or kept Stubb awake, but Stubb's own unwinking eye."
From the ship's bows, nearly all the seamen now hung inactive. Hammers, bits of plank, lances, and harpoons, mechanically retained in their hands, just as they had darted from their various employments. All their eyes were intent upon the whale, which from side to side, vibrating his predestinating head, sent a broad band of overspreading semicircular foam before him as he rushed. Retribution, swift vengeance, eternal malice were in his whole aspect, and in spite of all that mortal man could do, the solid white buttress of his forehead smote the ship's starboard bow till men and timbers reeled. Through the breach they heard the waters pour as mountain torrents down a flume.
"The ship!" cried Ahab from the boat. "The hearse! The second hearse! Its wood could only be American!"
Diving beneath the settling ship, the whale ran quivering along its keel, but turning underwater, swiftly shot to the surface again, far off the other bow, but within a few yards of Ahab's boat, where, for a time, he lay quiescent.
"Death, glorious ship!" cried Ahab. "Must ye then perish, and without me? Am I cut off from the last fond pride of meanest shipwrecked captains? Oh, lonely death on lonely life! Oh, now I feel my topmost greatness lies in my topmost grief. Towards thee I roll, thou all-destroying but unconquering whale! To the last I grapple with thee, from hell's heart I stab at thee, for hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee. Sink all coffins and all hearses to one common pool, and since neither can be mine, let me then tow to pieces while still chasing thee, though tied to thee, thou damned whale! Thus I give up the spear!"
The harpoon was darted. The stricken whale flew forward. With igniting velocity, the line ran through the groove, ran foul. Ahab stooped to clear it. He did clear it, but the flying turn caught him round the neck, and he was shot out of the boat ere the crew knew he was gone. Next instant, the heavy eye splice in the rope's end flew out of the stark, empty tub, knocked down an oarsman, and smiting the sea, disappeared in its depths. For an instant, the boat's crew stood still, then turned.
"The ship! Great God, where is the ship?"
Soon they saw through dim, bewildering mediums her sidelong, fading phantom, only the uppermost masts out of water, while fixed with infatuation, or fidelity, or fate to their once lofty perches, the pagan harpooners still maintain their sinking lookouts on the sea, and now concentric circles seize their lone boat itself, and all its crew, and each floating oar, and every lance pole, animate and inanimate, all round and round in one vortex, and spinning, carried the smallest chip of the Pequod out of sight. But as the last whelmings intermixingly poured themselves over the sunken head of the Indian at the mainmast, leaving a few inches of the erect spar yet visible, together with long streaming yards of the flag, which calmly undulated over the destroying billows they almost touched, at that instant, a red arm and a hammer hovered backwardly uplifted in the open air, in the act of nailing the flag faster and yet faster to the subsiding spar. A skyhawk that tauntingly had followed the main truck downwards from its natural home among the stars, pecking at the flag and incommoding Tashtego there, this bird now chanced to intercept its broad fluttering wing between the hammer and the wood, and simultaneously feeling that ethereal thrill, the submerged savage beneath, in his death grasp, kept his hammer frozen there. And so the bird of heaven, with his whole captive form folded in the flag of Ahab, went down with his ship, which, like Satan, would not sink to hell till she had dragged a living part of heaven along with her. Now small fowls flew screaming over the yet yawning gulf. A sullen white surf beat against its steep sides. Then all collapsed, and the great shroud of the sea rolled on as it rolled 5,000 years ago. The drama's done. Why then here does any one step forth? because one did survive the wreck. It so chanced that after the Parsi's disappearance, I was he whom the fates ordained to take the place of Ahab's bowsman, the same who, when on the last day the three men were tossed from out the rocking boat, was dropped astern. So, floating on the margin of the ensuing scene, and in full sight of it, when the half-spent suction of the sunk ship reached me, I was then but slowly drawn towards the closing vortex. When I reached it, it had subsided to a creamy pool. Round and round, then, and ever contracting towards the button-like black bubble at the axis of that slowly wheeling circle, I did revolve, till, gaining that vital center, the black bubble upward burst. And now, liberated by reason of its cunning spring, and owing to its great buoyancy, rising with great force, the coffin life-buoy, shot lengthwise from the sea, fell over and floated by my side. Buoyed up by that coffin, for almost one whole day and night, I floated on the soft and dirge-like main. The unharming sharks, they glided by as if with padlocks on their mouths. The savage seahawks sailed with sheathed beaks. And then, on the second day, a sail drew near, nearer, and picked me up at last. It was the devious cruising Rachel, that in her retracing search after her missing children, only found another orphan. This audiobook was produced and published by Penguin Books Limited.